Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here at this panel all about cannabis and driving. We have, this is one of the ISSDP sessions, so all the abstracts had to go through peer review, so you're kind of seeing the cream of the crop here. We're going to do the order a little differently. We are going to start with Ole Rogberg of the Frisch Center, then he's going to be followed by Eric Sevenier of Georgia State University, then Paul Larkin of the Heritage Foundation is going to be talking about some of the different laws surrounding cannabis and driving. And then we're going to end with Candace Leitner, who's the founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Each of the speakers will have about 15 minutes, no more than 15 minutes. I'm hoping less than 15 minutes. So then we can have about 15 to 20 minutes of conversation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ole.
Thank you. Okay, I'll be talking about, I guess I'll use the microphone here. I'll be talking about cannabis and traffic risks, and that was the wrong button. Here we go. So just very briefly on the background, traffic safety has been highlighted as one of the three primary reasons for concern about legalized cannabis. Past research has been summarized in a narrative review by Wayne Hall, as follows: the epidemiological and laboratory evidence on the acute effects of cannabis suggests strongly that cannabis users who drive while intoxicated increase their risk of motor vehicle crashes 2 to 3 times. So most of what I'm going to be presenting comes from an article that I've recently had in Addiction together with Rune Elvik from the Norwegian Transport Economics Institute. But I would like to just, and I guess that makes this an appropriate talk to open with the session, because I would just like to just go quickly through the causal chain here. Basically, we have, you have consumption of cannabis that causes physical and mental impairment. Then that physical and mental impairment alters your driving ability. That driving ability, in turn, alters your traffic crash risks, and we end up with traffic accidents over here. So on the first stage, the physical and the mental impairment, the research on that, which we did not sort of review in our study, we concerned ourselves only with the epidemiological research. But to quickly go through this, these are studies done in laboratory settings. So you bring people into the lab, you get them to smoke cannabis, and then you see how that alters their physiological and mental abilities. And they find strong effects. In a review of this evidence, it was stated that cannabis causes impairment in every performance area that can reasonably be connected with the safe driving of a vehicle. So we have a very good reason to be concerned that there might be serious effects here. The duration of these effects tend to be moderate. The effects peak during the first hour, and they're typically gone 3 to 4 hours after smoking. Then the question becomes, to what extent this impairs driving? You know, because as we age, for instance, we do have some sort of deterioration of certain mental faculties, but at the same time, we actually drive more safely. Young people will drive more recklessly, even though they have better, less impairment. So the second stage is the altered driving ability, and these are studies that are done in driving simulators, which can be extremely sophisticated, where you know the whole thing shakes as you're driving over gravel, close tracks, or on, in cars in real traffic with an extra set of pedals so that someone can intervene if something happens. The effects are moderate, more moderate than the laboratory results. In the driving simulator studies, you'll find some, they tend to drift more in the lane, be less stable in the lane, and overlook some relevant information. To some extent, they seem to be aware of their impairment and try to compensate. They keep a longer distance to cars ahead of them, and they overtake other cars less frequently and less aggressively. But the net effects still suggest impairment. In the Netherlands, they've also done three kinds of real traffic tests. One of them is follow a road, where you just drive along a road. You're supposed to follow that for an hour or something. And then they see this sort of veering in the lane. A second one is to follow another driver, where the main effect is that they kept a longer distance to the car. And the third one was to follow a preset route in a city, where they didn't really see any effects. However, these things still do not estimate the increased risk of traffic crashes. On the one hand, crashes are rare, and you would have to have people log a lot of hours in the lab in order to see accidents happen. The participants are aware that they're being observed. If you know that somebody's looking at you to see how impaired you're driving, you would probably try to be on your best behavior. And finally, these participants are being asked to drive stoned, and not all of them would have in real life. And that might also matter. So then we come to the stage three, the crash risk. And here, the setting is epidemiological and statistical studies of actual accidents in the real world. And the research question that these studies are trying to answer is, are stoned drivers involved in accidents more often than we would expect from chance? Are they overrepresented in accidents relative to their presence in traffic? So we need two estimates. We need an estimate of how common people on the road who are driving, how often they are impaired, or, you know, have different levels of cannabis intoxication. Then we need to look at the people who are in accidents and see how often these people have different levels of cannabis intoxication. Now, the studies are often small and with very varying results. And which one we should believe is difficult to know. So the solution that's typically done is to combine studies using what's called meta-analytic techniques, where you take the results from the different studies and you combine them, and if a study is precise and has large numbers, you give it more weight because it contains more information and is more precise about the effect you're trying to estimate. So these are the, this is the main results table from our paper, and to quickly explain, each line here is one study that has been done. The stapled line here going straight up is no effect. You know, the same, no increased traffic risk. If each study has a point in the middle and a line, the length of the line says something, it's a 95% confidence interval, it says something about the precision of the study, and the dot in the middle says, you know, what the point estimate is. And you can see that there's quite a lot of variation here in terms of where these points lie and how precise the studies are. But in general, when we collect, take all these studies and just, sorry, I just need a little water. When you combine all these studies, the end result, which you might not be able to read, is a 36% increase in traffic crash risk. We use two different meta-analytic techniques. We use one called random effects model, and we also use something called a Pease meta-regression, which some people have argued is better able to capture small study bias and publication bias in the literature. And we try to compare, you know, these different subgroups of studies. So if you take all studies, we can see that the... Do you still hear me like this? Okay. So if you take all the studies, we see that the risks are between 20 and 40%, depending on which of these two techniques you use. If you look only at the low-quality studies, these are substantially higher. If you look at only the high-quality studies, and quality in this, quality in this setting is based on a score that we have in the paper with different things that need to be in place based on, you know, traffic literature. And good quality studies tend to find lower risks, but we see that they're pretty much the same as if you take all studies combined. We can also look at those that are poorly controlled, because we know there are other factors that influence whether you have a risk. For instance, cannabis is more commonly used by young males. Young males tend to drive more recklessly and have more accidents whether or not they smoke. If you don't take that into consideration, some of what you think is due to cannabis is actually due to age and gender. The well-controlled studies have substantially lower risks, even a bit lower actually than all the studies combined. And if you just look at the studies that are able to control for alcohol, whether or not you had also consumed alcohol at the same time, the studies that control for that find, again, pretty small effects of cannabis. One way to interpret this is if you had like a huge number of accidents with cannabis, like people who have then have cannabis in their blood, THC in the blood, in some level, what share of those accidents would we have avoided if they had not consumed cannabis? And if you use these estimates that are the all studies, high quality, well-controlled, and controls for alcohol, it's somewhere in the range 10 to 30% of the accidents would have been avoided if these people had not consumed cannabis. And to put that in perspective, if you do the same thing, there's a cool study by Stephen Levitt and Porter, when they look at, they use the FARS database, and they try to see to what extent does being suspected of having drunk alcohol by the officer who comes to the accident, to what extent does that seem to increase your accident risk? They find a 600% risk increase, I think it is. And that implies that 85% of all those accidents would have been avoided if the person had not been consuming alcohol at the time. So what was the evidence for the earlier claims of larger effects? It's two past meta-analyses, one from the British Medical Journal, one from Epidemiological Reviews, both of them with
thanks. Both of them with 9 studies. They found studies that they suggested a 96% increase in risk and a 166% increase in risk. To understand why that differed, we went back to those studies. We took those studies that they had used, and we re-extracted the data, and we reanalyzed it. And we found a number of issues. So one thing was the study by Lee averages studies that answer completely different questions. So some of the studies are asking, have past year uses of cannabis been more likely to say they've been in an accident in the past year? Other studies have asked the question, do people who admit to having driven while stoned in the last year, do they more often report having had accidents in the last year? That's a very different question, actually, than whether or not being acutely impaired right now influences your risk. The second thing was, when we just went to the original studies and extracted the data needed for the analysis, we found that there was quite serious flaws, especially for aspirates. With one study, it had been coded as having a 7-fold increase in risk, whereas the accurate one was like 2.5 or something. The third one is, there's two different kinds of studies here, something called culpability estimate and something called case control study. They're both used, but they're not actually completely comparable, and you have to adjust the culpability studies to make them comparable and to be able to pool them, which was not done. Finally, both of them failed to adjust for small study bias, which is a real issue in this field because a lot of these studies are pretty small, and neither of them use adjusted estimates that correct for other known risk factors. So when we did this, here's the results for Aspridge. This is the original reported point estimate and the uncertainty around that, and as this is just from getting the data correct. And then as we do these different adjustments, we end up with a result which is basically almost the same as what we have. With Lee, you don't have the culpability study, so there's fewer adjustments to be made, but again, it goes quite a lot down. And the original reported estimates are now outside what we find as the revised confidence intervals. So, is stone driving safe? No. Because remember, this is the average risk for a group of recent cannabis users who decided to drive. And a lot of these studies will use quite low thresholds to define you as cannabis impaired. So the average effect is the average over people who may not have been impaired, but who had used in the previous day or the previous hours, but who were not acutely intoxicated. And the risks of a strong acute intoxication may be higher. However, this average that we find may be appropriate to when we're thinking about the statistics that we hear about cannabis-involved driving, which frequently use the same kinds of cutoffs. As a social issue, this is a substantially lower danger than alcohol. The average increase, as I mentioned, for drinking drivers, not all of whom are acutely intoxicated, so we have the same issue there, was the 650% increase. So if sizable shares of cannabis users had had very high risks, we would have seen it in the average. And I think that's one of the things you need to, like, people would say, well, this includes people who are not impaired. Of course, you're going to get a low estimate. Yes, but the average tells you something, because there's a share of those people who, and they can't have very high risk, otherwise we would have seen it in the average. However, finally, I would like to note that these estimates are still uncertain, and that's based partly because of the uncertainty in these kinds of studies. If the people who drive stoned are the people who feel the least impaired from a certain amount of THC in their blood, then the people who today think, oh my God, I don't think I should drive, they would have high risks. And then there's, okay, I'm out of time, but basically, there's some factors that lead you to think there might be overestimates here. Some people that make it pull it towards being underestimates. For instance, if the people who drive stone tend to be people who are more high-risk drivers, there's some evidence of that. They tend to drive and drink more often. They drive more aggressively. They think it's more fun to drive fast. So there's issues on all of this, but this is, it was what we were able to do with the data so far. Thanks.
Well, that was excellent. I really liked how you went back to the off-site and meta-analyses and replicated what they did. That was great. Next up, we have Eric Sevigny, who's going to be talking about the effects of state marijuana laws on marijuana-involved driving, evident from the U.S. PARS database.
Thanks, Bo. I couldn't have had a better lead into my study. Ole really summarized the research on these issues nicely. Leads into, I actually use in this analysis the FARS data to analyze marijuana-involved driving using a 50 or 51 state sample with DC to look at the impacts of state marijuana laws. So The background, these first two bullet points, are really what Ole just reviewed for us. So these developments have led to heightened risks or heightened concerns over road safety. So I won't spend too much time on that because we just had a nice presentation on that. But a third development is in the United States are the rapidly evolving marijuana policy environment. We see that we have 20 states now who have decriminalized marijuana. That movement really began in the 70s. And we had like a 30-year interregnum where no policies were passed. But starting in 2009 with Massachusetts, we've had more states pass decrim laws. Missouri will become the 20th state actually in 2017. So this is actually preceding some of that law. Medical marijuana laws exist in 24 states now, beginning with California in 1996. And we also have five states that have recreational marijuana laws that legalize marijuana for adults and commercialization, except for in D.C. At this point. So these policy developments impact, you know, through lower deterrence to use and greater access, potentially driving while stoned, if you will. There's also a series of countervailing state policies that seek to mitigate some of these harms. Things like THC per se laws, which place a limit, and this limit varies across the states, on the amount of marijuana or THC or metabolite that can be in your blood. Above that limit, you are driving impaired legally, illegally. So 17 states have a law to that effect. So with this background, and I know you're not going to be able to see this, but really, this is the enactment dates, or actually the effective dates, of all these particular state laws that may impact driving while high. Okay, so we have these decrim laws, and the states that passed these laws in the 70s. I just show that year of passage because that's before the time period of this study. So we have these laws that are being passed, these don't represent all 51 states, but these are all states that have at least one of these laws. We have medical marijuana laws, and what this represents is the point at which patients became legally protected to consume marijuana. And we have various aspects or supply mechanisms with marijuana laws that we control for as well. One is home cultivation, and you'll see these subscript letters. What that means is that a U means a universal allowance for home cultivation, whereas a P means permitted cultivation. You need to have a permit to cultivate, like in New Mexico. You need a personal production license, for example. So we code for that. We also look at dispensaries as the other supply mechanism. And the L means licensed and operational. That means that the state has a licensed and operational program to legally dispense marijuana to medical patients. And operational means that, you know, we know that a lot of dispensaries kind of just popped up in states like Michigan, Montana, et cetera. So they existed illegally or quasi-illegally. And since we're interested in how supply affects marijuana-involved driving, we control for that as well through our best attempt to establish when that occurred, okay? And then we have legalization. At this point, these laws are all coded up through the end of 2014, so we only have the two states, Washington and Colorado, that have legalized, and then we have the THC per se laws. So a lot there, but by way of introduction, I want to review six studies that I'm aware of that have looked at the impacts of any one of these marijuana laws on marijuana-involved driving or road traffic crashes, okay? And I'll try to do this quickly. Pellini, this is a recent study, looked at California decriminalization. And there it says 2011 because what happened is California decriminalized marijuana by making it, reducing it from a criminal offense to an infraction, whereas the 1970 decrim made jail an impossibility for low-level possession of marijuana. The study looked at two data sources, California Roadside Survey, which selects drivers randomly. In certain areas and ask them to be tested for drugs and interviews them. And then the FARS data, which is the Fatality Analysis Reporting System, which is a data that I'll be using. It's a federal data system that includes all federal, fatal vehicle accidents in the United States is in the system. They use a simple pre-post analysis, and basically they find that there's no significant change in cannabis positive driving from the roadside surveys, but they find a significant positive increase in THC positivity across the study period. So some conflicting results, focuses on one state, and we're really dealing with limited policy change. Cooper and Peterson more recently, around the same time, look at Washington's legalization. And what they use are toxicology results from submitted from impaired drivers across the time frame of 2009 to 2013. It's a simple pre-post analysis, no controls. They find a significant increase in THC positivity as well as some metabolites of THC across this time period, going from an average of, and I'll just focus on THC, 19% in the pre-law period to 25% after legalization. So we see some evidence of an increase. However, changes in laboratory testing procedures cannot be ruled out, as well as maybe more intensive enforcement. Anderson and Reese is the only study that has looked at drug per se laws. And what they do, they use the FARS data using a differences and differences approach, which is what I use here as well. But they don't find any evidence that these laws impact the traffic fatality rate. It doesn't focus on THC per se, and it doesn't address missing data issues. These three studies, and I'll try to go through them quickly, are the only studies I found that focus on the impacts of medical marijuana laws on marijuana-involved driving. We have Massen and Gutzberger. They look at state medical marijuana laws across 92 to 2009 for FARS using an interrupted time series analysis. They find some evidence in three states of an increase in cannabis positivity driving. Does not explain, an access index didn't explain any of this variation. There's a few post-law observations for some states. Salomonson and Sato looked at Colorado's medical marijuana law. And we see some of the same things. The main thing, I got a 10-minute warning, is that the evidence base is slim and inconclusive on the impacts of these laws on marijuana-involved driving. So the current study that I'm presenting today uses 1993 to 2014 FARS data to look at, and that's a census of all fatal vehicle, of all drivers involved in fatal vehicle accidents in the United States for these years. So we're talking 1.2 million cases nearly across this 22-year study period. We estimate a differences and differences framework, a logistic regression model within a multiple imputation framework. I'll explain that in a minute. We control for a host of driver level factors, individual level contextual factors, other potential rival state policies, and background factors, and state and year fixed effects. The main model you see there is we're estimating cannabis positivity for individual I and state S at time T with a set of individual level controls, the marijuana laws, the host of other controls, and state and year fixed effects, essentially. And then I'll show you some robustness and falsification tests that we perform as well. So that's the gist of it. Here is, I'm not going to go through all the controls in the study, but it does include, I don't know if we have a pointer on yet.
The little red button.
Yeah. So it includes a bunch of driver level factors. Also, if they tested positive for other drugs, excuse me, their race, age, BMI, which is related to whether they test positive and so forth, and then certain kinds of driver level risk factors, speeding, a prior incident, whether they were distracted and so on, control for individual level contextual factors, were there adverse driving conditions, were they driving at night, were they driving on the weekend or during a holiday period, and so forth. And we also, these are the state policies we control for, and we have some other state and regional controls. So it's a pretty well controlled study looking at these outcomes. One thing I will point out, and I will talk about this next, the amount of missing data for the drug testing and the alcohol content variables is incredibly high. We're talking 3/4 nearly for the drug outcomes, and over half for the BAC. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the imputation, but let me just say this, and I will be happy to talk more about exactly what I did. NHTSA has long used multiple imputation, which is an approach to predict the missing data using a model across and then creating multiple data sets, which are then analyzed and combined through some statistical rules to produce results that are hopefully unbiased and efficient to account for that missing data. So it's a pretty state-of-the-art methodology and approach. There's key assumptions and so forth underlying all this, but I'll save that for the question and answer period because I really do want to get to the results. And I do, I did prepare some, pretty well-developed slides on this because it is a pretty important point. I would just say that I estimated 100 data sets, which were then analyzed, and the results that I present here are the combination of this multiple imputation process. So, what do we see? I'm just going to show you the policy variables. These are odds ratios, and what we see across this time period in terms of these state laws are a couple of things. One, and we see a large effect with marijuana decrim, but it's not significant. But we can't discount this because we're really dealing with a census of drivers here who were involved in fatal accidents. But those states that have licensed dispensaries, the state regulates and licenses dispensaries, so basically commercial medical marijuana states with commercialization and dispensary access, we see a significant increase in marijuana positivity results in those states, and that's a significant effect. Alternatively, in those states that have these THC per se laws that are meant to control that risk, we see a reduced odds of testing positive for marijuana. So the gist of this particular analysis suggests that some state marijuana laws increase the likelihood of testing positive. So one caveat I will say, and I do have another series of, I won't go through all these. These are a bunch of sensitivity analyses and falsification tests. And I will quickly, I'm out of time, I know. We'll show, just take the brief point here, is that if these laws, this is a falsification test, so we actually predict these laws on other outcomes, narcotics, depressants, stimulants, and alcohol, and we really don't see any effect like we did earlier. We see this one puzzling effect with dispensaries that are illegal but operational, can't really explain that at this point. But the summary and conclusion of these findings from this research are few. One is that the medical marijuana states with licensed and operational dispensaries have a significantly greater odds of drivers testing positive for THC. States with THC per se laws have the opposite effect. And no other policies were significant, although decrim laws had a large effect size. Robustness in analyses and falsification tests seem to support that conclusion. And a few policy implications, which I'll let you read and be happy to discuss more of this research at the end, because I know that I am out of time and will leave room for other people to talk. So thank you.
Thank you, Eric, for another great empirical paper. Next up, we have Paul Larkin talking about medical recreational marijuana and drug driving with a real focus on the laws in different states.